When the young Alfred Charles Sharpton told his mother he wanted to be a preacher, little did he know that his journey would also lead him to prominence as a politician, founder of the National Action Network, civil rights activist, and television and radio talk show host. His ability and willingness to take on the political power structure makes him the preeminent voice for the modern era, a time unprecedented in its challenges. In his new book, Rise Up, Confronting a Country at the Crossroads, Reverend Sharpton revisits the highlights of the Obama administration, the 2016 election, and Trump's subsequent hold on the GOP, and draws on his decades-long experience with other key players in politics and activism, including Shirley Chisholm, Hillary Clinton, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., and more. The new book is Rise Up. It is published by Hanover Square Press, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Reverend Al Sharpton to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
What brought you to want to write this and feeling that we're not just at a crossroads, we are at the crossroads?
Well, when I looked at where we had began moving toward in the last administration of Barack Obama, dealing with health care and making it, for the first time in decades, available to people that had been excluded, people with pre-existing conditions, young people up to age 26. When I looked at, we were able, and I had involvement in that, to deal with police reform, where there were several cities put under consent decrees with the Justice Department, where we began to deal with voting suppression methods. There were lawsuits from the Justice Department, in particular in Texas and in North Carolina, around voter ID and other methods. And we were moving toward a road of fulfilling some of the things that I felt was important for not only the black community and brown community, but women and gays, same-sex marriage and others. And then we were followed up with the Trump administration that openly opposed and in some cases stopped, in the cases of the consent decrees and all, stopped all of that. This was a diametrically opposing road, and it got clearer and clearer as they dismantled some of the police reform, as they withdrew some of the voting rights legislation, as they began making moves around the question of Affordable Care Act. I said we are clearly dealing with that we're at a crossroad that will, if they are able to cement with the almost 200 federal judges, and now, even since I finished the book on Supreme Court justice, we are at a crossroad that could impact where this country goes for generations. And that's what motivated me to sit down and say, we've got to decide which road we're going to travel and rise up behind the road we choose.
So let's talk for a minute just about voting itself. As we look, here we are, and we are just less than a month away from just about a month away from the election. Where do you think the problems still exist in voting, and is what meaningful things do you think we can do over these very few days to make that problem better?
Well, the problem is that we, with the Section 4 taken out of the Voting Rights Act, states now can, without any oversight, change election laws in the state. For example, in the state of Georgia, we see where Kemp purged several hundred thousand voters, mostly in black districts, and moved voting sites. If the Voting Rights Act Section 4 was still in place, they would have had to get preclearance to do that from the Justice Department, and on and on and on. So I think that where we are is in a precarious place. The only thing we could do with a little over a month is to get mass turnout, as we did in 08 and in 12, that would overwhelm them that have these impediments in place, that they could not use them to in any way limit the impact of our votes. And I think that then we should immediately put into law, which we've already had passed the House of Representatives, the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, which would in fact put in place a map that the Supreme Court had said when it ruled Section 4 out is to give a new updated map. We've been saying all along, we need the new map to answer the Supreme Court. Now, I'm sure that they would challenge it on the other side, but it would take them time to go back up through the courts to the Supreme Court to do so. So we should do that immediately. We just had a march August 28th, about 4 weeks ago, with tens of thousands of people in Washington around the anniversary of the original 63 march. And the two legislative pieces that we pushed at that march was this act, the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, and the George Floyd Policing and Justice Act.
I want to get to George Floyd in a moment, but when it comes to voting, for African Americans, at looking at this ticket of Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, is that a good ticket for the people that you were talking to come together and to rise up and to get behind?
I think that politics is about choices. And I think that when you look at what the Biden-Harris ticket has said about voting, about criminal justice, about women's right to choose, about LGBTQ rights, about climate change, that they have a much better position to the people that I'm talking to than the Trump administration, which is diametrically opposed on all of those areas.
You write in the book, you have a chapter, and you talk about the rise of the latte liberal and purity politics. What do you mean by that, and how is it impacting us?
I think that there is a certain group that are liberals who really don't engage in hand-to-hand fighting on these issues that I've just outlined, but sit up in privileged positions and take positions and policies that are purists, that you've got to go by my 10 points or you are not really on our side, and never understanding that sometimes we've got to fight, have 10 points, and say, if we can get 7, let's do that, because we're on the ground where people are suffering. And we can't tell people, well, if we can't get all 10, don't worry about your pre-existing condition. If we can't get all 10, don't worry about the cop beat up your son. And I'm saying those that sit back sipping lattes and are purists and want to dictate a movement saying all or none are not the people that are on the ground making change happen. And it has happened with every social movement that I've studied and for the last few decades that I've been involved in.
Mm. How did we get to that point of why that became even an option, not to take what you can get?
Well, I think it has not gotten to the point where it's not an option. I was just identifying those that want to make it an option.
Right.
I think that there's been some that have taken that position. I think the overwhelming majority of those that have been active has rejected that.
You do, actually, in the last part of the book, you're writing about George Floyd, and you're writing about as you were writing this book, this happened, the murder of George Floyd happened right after you had completed the book, and you do include that by the time it got to print. In many ways, it went to show us what you had been saying in all of the previous pages. But how did that particular death change you and really change us in a year that we're not only dealing with a presidential election, but we're also dealing with a global pandemic, and something that after being locked in our houses for weeks and months, the people got out and took to the streets?
I think that the pandemic had a lot to do with how it changed a lot of what was going on in the country, because we were locked in, as you say, accurately, and people were watching the news. They couldn't watch sports. There were no sports activities, no basketball, no football, no baseball. And they're watching the news, hoping every day the news would give them a better picture of when they could go out, when this virus would level off. And they see this film, this video, over and over again of this knee from a law enforcement officer on the neck of a man for 8 minutes and 41 seconds. We had videos before. We had a video of Eric Garner. But people had ways of seeing it and then going to the ball game or going out to dinner or going to some social event. They were locked in and couldn't get away this time. And I think it caused people that never really saw the severity of these things say, wait a minute, something has to happen. And the way it changed me is I began to see that some of the issues that we've been fighting for decades around, particularly around policing, was now finally hit a core of Americans that wanted to do something about it. I started going to rallies and marches and vigils where in some cases there were more whites than blacks. So it gave me the hope and possibilities that we can have an intersectional movement and fight for everybody, including the George Floyds of the world, with more allies than we've had in the past.
You write in the book, peaceful protesters called for justice and an end to systemic racism and police brutality. These protesters demanded nothing short of equal protection under the law, a new kind of normal. Their cries that Black Lives Matter were often met by a retaliatory, militarized police force whose violent use of batons, rubber bullets, and gas were encouraged by President Trump, a man who took shelter in the White House bunker and erected fencing to keep those protesters at bay. The president, of course, has continued to make this an election issue, and it doesn't seem to be one that is resonating with the people.
No, it doesn't. I mean, when you have a president that says, you know, when you arrest someone, don't be so nice to them. Why do y'all put your hand on his head to help them get in the back of a car when they're handcuffed? Be rough with them. And has said things like that. He's encouraging this kind of physical force, this kind of militarized atmosphere. I'm going to send in the National Guard. All of this, rather than deal with the cries for justice and the cries for accountability. And it is absolutely above and beyond what you would expect for a head of state to do when you have a litany of cases. Don't forget that we had the George Floyd case, the Ahmaud Arbery case where a man was killed jogging in Brunswick, Georgia, the Breonna Taylor case, woman killed in her own home by police coming in with a no-knock warrant, and the case of Rashad Brooks in Atlanta, all happened within weeks of each other. So at what point do you stop and say, wait a minute, we have a problem here? And his response was, meet it with force and always back the police. And you have an attorney general appointed by the president that accused in Kenosha, Blake, the young man shot in the back seven times, saying, oh, he was committing a felony and had a weapon. Well, what felony? I thought they were investigating it. He's already prejudged that there was some justification for shooting the man in the back that we all saw on video.
When it comes to Breonna Taylor, I'm interested in what you make. The Kentucky Attorney General's office is saying that it's going to release the panel's recordings after a grand juror contended in a court filing that its discussions were inaccurately characterized. What do we make of the fact that no one in that case has, none of the officers involved have been charged?
No one can explain to me why no one was charged. How do you charge someone with endangering those in the vicinity, the neighbors, but you don't charge anyone for who was killed, who had done nothing but go to bed that night. She was not suspected of a crime. She had was not committing a crime. And even if she was, you don't have the right to shoot her unless it was in self-defense. So clearly, one has to wonder what was presented to the grand jury. You had to remember, the only one that goes in the grand jury is the prosecutor and the witnesses the prosecutor calls. The lawyer for the families, the lawyer for others are not allowed in the grand jury. So the only thing you can do, as Attorney Benjamin Crump had demanded, and now you have this juror saying, is we need to know what they were told and what they were not told. There was a former chief judge in the state of New York that used to say you can indict a ham sandwich if you want to.
Right.
Well, the reverse is also true. You cannot indict a ham sandwich if you want to. I think that's too much power to give a prosecutor, and I think we need to know what was put in front of this grand jury and what may have been omitted that may have said to this grand jury, you can't indict because they did not get all of the information or evidence that may have been available to have given them.
Can the outcome be overturned? And number one, and number two, where do you believe that that leads in the way it was handled by Attorney General Daniel Cameron?
It can be if there, in fact, is evidence that there was evidence that was not presented, then in the name of new evidence, you can convene a new grand jury and go ahead and prosecute. Or you can take other measures, other jurisdictions, federal or whatever. But first, we need to know what was presented and not presented. And I think if we find that there was negligence or the thumb on the scale by Mr. Cameron, then I think that there would be that would have to be addressed, whether it would be a recall or wait on the next election. It would be depending on what is uncovered once we see what was presented. You have to ask yourself that for a member of the grand jury to say, put it out there, that's not how the discussion went, makes you even more suspect on what was said and what was not said that made a grand jury come to that conclusion.
What is it like for you, as we wrap up our conversation, what is it like for you when you get one of these calls that a number one of these horrific incidents have taken place? The murder of unarmed people by law enforcement.
It is very, to me, it is at one point a sense of sadness of here we go again. And on the other point, this is what my life's work is. And I feel that that's what I am supposed to do. So I say on a sad side, here we go again. And then I say, based on my life's mission, yes, here we go again. And we can't weary in well-doing, as the Bible says. We got to keep going until we can stop this. I've seen some cases successful, but I think that we need to change the laws. That's why we did the big march in Washington. That's why we're going to continue pressing to get the George Floyd bill passed. If we can change the laws, I think we can change a lot of the continuing litany of these kinds of murders going down.
You do think that the number of calls that you get in any given year can decrease substantially?
Absolutely. I think the reason is that once police know that they are accountable, that they can be prosecuted, that they will no longer have immunity from lawsuits, and know they can lose their house, their car, not just the city payoff or civil suits, once they know they have skin in the game, they would be more abiding by what is legal and what is ethical.
Reverend Earl Sharpton's new book is Rise Up, Confronting a Country at the Crossroads. It is published by Hanover Square Press. Reverend Sharpton, a great pleasure. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Be well. Again, the name of the book is Rise Up. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.